Hello, everyone. Thank you for inviting me. My name is Ralph Giles. I come from Vancouver on the western edge of Canada to talk to you about Ogg Theora, our free video codec. I also work with the ZipOrg Foundation, like Jack Moffat, who spoke before lunch. And I'm going to talk about our codec here. If perhaps you've seen it playing during the lunch. This is a Creative Commons video, so it's free content that you can distribute, encoded in Theora, which means it's free to distribute to players, and you don't owe any money for any of it. And I wish I could show you a better one, but this is a very slow laptop, and so this is as big a video as I can manage. But also, many of you got a demo CD-ROM. We brought about 50 with us, but you can also download the ISO directly from here, and Mishko is going to put it up on the Cebit server so you can get a local copy, which might be faster for you. So, as Jack said, the ZipOrg Foundation is dedicated to producing a free multimedia platforms, things that so you can play your music and your movies and everything else without having to pay royalties to anyone. So not just free software, but free codecs and freedom from software patents. If you're lucky, Europe will not adopt software patents, and you won't have this issue. But much of the rest of the world does. So I think it's important that we have the alternative. So Ogg Theora, it rocks, right? It's free. I've said that a couple of times, and you should all use it. The thing we've discovered in producing these new formats is that it's very difficult to get users to say, oh yes, we want this format. If it's really good, really a lot better than what you can get elsewhere, then the geeky people will like it better. But ordinary people can't be bothered. So what really drives adoption of new formats is the people who produce content, put their videos, put their music up online, and they get to choose which format it goes in. And then if your stuff's good, then everybody will download our codec so they can watch it. So if you want to drive adoption, it's much better to put your videos up in Theora than it is to tell your friends that Theora is a good video codec and maybe they should try installing it on their computer and watch some videos if they can find them. So I'm going to talk about the technical details of Theora, at least a little bit. But before that, I wanted to go over some of how compression works. And if any of you have had a data compression class at the university, this will probably all be a review. A lot of these building blocks go into Theora. Video codec is quite complicated, and I think it helps to understand some of the background and the details. So how does compression work? I mean, you have a file on your hard drive, and you want to make it smaller, and how can you make it smaller? Speak slowly, thanks. I'm sorry. I don't speak Czech at all, so I understand. So you have a file on your hard drive, and you want to make it smaller. And the way compression works is it makes it smaller by finding redundant bits of the file, things that don't have to be there to represent the information. And if you take out the bits that you don't need to represent the information, you have less information, and so the file becomes smaller. Generally, the more you know about the data you're trying to compress, the better job you can do by compressing it, because removing redundancy is not easy. I mean, obviously, if there's a bunch of zeros on the end, that don't mean anything in a text file, you can remove them. But in general, you have to understand your data and what's important about it and what isn't, and understand how to rearrange it to be able to make a smaller file. And Jack touched on this as well, but there are two general classes of compression, at least where multimedia is concerned. There's what we call lossless compression. So that makes the file smaller, but preserves all of the information in the original video or music. And there are lossy codecs, which they lose information when they compress. So they produce something that's similar, but not the same. And people do this because it turns out you can get a lot more compression efficiency that way. So how do you remove redundant information? Computers can process data, and they can rearrange bits. So how can we make something smaller? You can take a program and a bit stream that's input to the program, and running the program with the bitstream as input generates a new bitstream. The program itself is a bitstream, the compressed thing is a bitstream, and then the uncompressed thing is a bitstream. So what we want to do is make that an inequality in size so that the program and the bitstream together are smaller than the original uncompressed bitstream. So mathematically speaking, we can define the complexity of a bitstream as the smallest program that can reproduce it. So pi is an infinitely long number. If you write out 3.14159675759, whatever, it goes on forever. But you can write a finite-sized program that will generate all of those digits as you go along. So the complexity of pi is less than infinity. This is a mathematical definition, and it's hard to reach in practice. But in general, what we want to create something that compresses something is that the size of the program that does the decompression and the size of the compressed stream will be less than the size of the original stream, and in general, they'll be greater than this complexity limit. So that sets a lower bound on how well we can compress things. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to calculate this, but that's how people talk about it mathematically. Practically speaking, I mean, there is this theoretical lower bound, but limitations in how much computer power you have limits what you can do. And the history of multimedia compression is about trading off more CPU power and more complexity in the decoder for a greater savings in the size of the file. So as computers get faster, we build new codecs which are more efficient at compressing things, but that take a lot more power. So MP3 is, you know, better than Mace or whatever people used to use for audio. And Theora is more complicated than MPEG-1, and it also does a better job compressing video. So in general, we refer to programs that compress things and then decompress them later as a codec, which stands for compression and decompression. So let's do some examples of compression. One simple one that occasionally shows up in the news is called embarrassing compression. I use that in analogy to embarrassingly parallel programs. So converting a program from a serial computer to one that will run on a parallel computer is difficult. But one of the easy ways to do it is to just run one copy of the serial program on every processor in the parallel thing. And people call that embarrassingly parallel because you say, oh, look, I made it parallel, but you didn't really do anything. And people have done this with multimedia, too, usually as a scam. You can compress n different bit streams into n bits because what your decompression program does is it says, okay, my compressed bit stream is 5, so I look up 5 in my index of media files, and I play media file number 5. And that's not really a reduction in complexity, of course, in the mathematical sense, because your decoder is bigger than your input file, than your uncompressed video files, because it has to be able to select them. But there was a funny story. I guess it's happened twice. There was a con artist in the United States and also a teenager in Australia who started companies to sell a wonderful new video compression technology. It could do high-quality, DVD-quality video over a modem line. I think the Australian one promised this in 1999. And no, you can't really see the technology until you agree to buy it. But we'll do a demonstration for you. And it turned out, in at least the case of the Australian one, he waited about 4 years, and finally a company did buy the technology, and they did a demonstration. And they were a little skeptical, so they tried things like, well, what if we unplug the network connection, the modem on which this video is streaming? And amazingly enough, the video kept playing. So it turned out what he had done, what his marvelous video technology was, is VP3, which is the QuickTime codec that Theora is based on, and the movie, all wrapped up together. So it looks like a codec. You install this, and it plays that one movie. And what comes over the modem doesn't matter at all. So they were a little upset. It was published in their shareholder report that, yes, we have bought this wonderful new technology, and it's not going to make us rich. So I'll talk about lossless algorithms first, because that's really the foundation of everything. You want to be able to compress things without losing data, to take whatever you've done with your lossy codec and make it fit as well as you can. So it's sort of the lowest level of a codec design. So in a lossless compression scheme, what goes in comes exactly back out. And considered overall, Vorbis and Theora are lossy, but the lower levels, like the vector quantization and the Huffman coding that Vorbis does, is lossless. So some examples. Say we want to compress an example string of characters, AA, BB, CC, AA, AA, BCC. If we store this just as a string in memory, it's going to be 8-bit characters. So you need 13 bytes, or 104 bits, to store that string. But 8-bit characters assume you have every letter in the alphabet, all the extra diacritics, control characters. And if the string is only ever going to have A, B, and C in it, you don't need 8 bits per character. You can store it with 2 bits per character, which gives you 4 options. One you don't use, and then the other 3 are A, B, and C. So in binary, that would be A is 00, B is 10, C is 11, for example. And that gives you a reduction to 25% of the original size. With 2-bit characters, you only need 13 times 2, or 26 bits, instead of 104. So that's 1/4 of the original size. What if some symbols are more common than others? You can save additional space by using a variable length encoding. So I say 1.5 bits per character, but what that means is some characters use 1 bit, some characters use 2 bits. The trick with this is knowing how many bits to read. With 8-bit bytes, you know you always read 8 bytes per character. With 2-bit characters, you read 2 bits, but you need some scheme to know how long each of them is. So for example, we could say that A is obviously the most common in this string, so we're going to call that just 0, just 1 bit, and B and C can be, just like the 2-bit encoding, 10 and 11. And this is what's known as a Huffman code, and the trick is that we know that things that start with 0 are 1 bit, and things that start with 1 are 2 bits. So as you read through, you always know how many bits to read. So in Huffman coding, you build a binary tree with a prefix. I mean, you can extend this to larger numbers of symbols, but the prefix always tells you how long the symbol's going to be. So in our example, you can see it compresses to 20 bits, which is 19% of the original 104 bits. Huffman coding is most efficient when the symbol probabilities are a negative power of 2, 1/2, 1/4, 1/8, and 1/16. Because you're building this binary tree, you're most efficient when the symbols actually occur with something that fits in a binary subdivision of those trees. If your symbols aren't like that, for instance, if you have A, B, and C, but A only occurs once in every 6,000, then Huffman coding isn't so efficient. There are other techniques, for example, arithmetic coding, that are efficient for that, but they are slower, and most of the useful applications of them are still patented. So JPEG 2000, the Dirac codec the BBC has released, all use the JBIG2 image compression format, all use arithmetic coding. Another example are what are called dictionary algorithms. I'll talk about LZ77 because it's commonly used in a lot of open source software. And the simple idea is that we're looking for redundancy, and we've talked about how we can use fewer numbers of bits to store each symbol. But you can also look for repeated sequences, and instead of storing since repeated sequences are redundant, you can just store a lookup table. So you keep a dictionary of everything you see, and then when you see a repeat of it, you just insert a reference to the dictionary. LZ77 was the first one published, and it wasn't patented, unlike LZW, LZ78, and a whole bunch of others that were. LZW is famous for being in the GIF image format, file format, and Unisys has a patent on it and started suing everyone in the 90s, and that's why we have Ping, and why we don't use LZW very much. So to be more specific, when you go through with LZW, you scan your string of characters, and you store new subsets of the characters that you haven't seen before literally, so A, B, C, whatever. But whenever you see one that's repeated, you replace that repeated string with a reference back to a previous occurrence. So there's a sliding window of 32 kilobytes that goes through the data, and whenever you see something that occurs, a string that occurred before in that 32 kilobytes, instead of encoding that string, you say, go back so many bytes and copy so many other bytes. So in our example, AA, BB, CC have never occurred before, so you would code those literally. But then the next thing would be AA again. And since you've seen that, you say, go back 6 bytes, so 6 characters, and you copy 2, so that gives you AA. The next bit would be another set of AA, so you go back, I guess that should be 8 bytes. Or 2 bytes, yes, and copy 2. You can't copy 4 because there's no set of 4 A's before. But yeah, so it should be 8 or 2, I'm sorry. And then to get the 1B, you go back by 7. And to get the 2Cs, you go back by 7 but copy 2. So that's how LZ77 works. LZ77 and Huffman coding together make up what's called the deflate coding algorithm. And this is the basis for the popular GZIP program, which does general purpose file compression. It's also the basis for the ping image format for the FLAC audio codec that Jack talked about. For it's used in PDF and PostScript documents to compress the size, the image data. And it's documented in RFC 1951. And it's become very popular for generic lossless compression because it does a fairly good job. It's completely unpatented. It's well understood. It's a standard published by the IETF. And there's an easy open source implementation called Zlib, which I'm sure you've had to install at some point on your Linux machine. So what else can we do to make things better? Again, a model of your data, the more you understand about the data, the better a job you can do. So you can use a model to predict what's going to happen and then encode only the difference. And if you predict better than average, that will generally reduce the amount of information you have to store as the difference. You can also transform your data to a different arrangement, which will concentrate the complexity that you care about in a smaller number of bits. So as an example of predictors, FLAC and Speaks both use predictors. As Jack talked about, you look at the audio wave file, and you try and predict with a polynomial where the next sample will be in FLAC, and then you only have to encode the difference between the prediction, which is generally a smaller number than the numbers you need to encode the whole waveform. Speaks does a similar thing by modeling the human voice. The ping image format uses deflate to compress each row, but before it compresses each row, it runs a predictor on the image data encoding, for example, only the difference between pixels. Or there's 6 different ones that you can try, and it tries to pick the best one to make the data compress the best. And this general model applies to almost every codec. Vorbis and Theora both do this in a high-level sense, but the details are much more complicated. Another example, transforming the data. And the idea here is that you want to rearrange the bits in some standardized way which concentrates information. And so one thing that's done in JPEG and Theora and analog television, it turns out, is to convert a general image where colors are represented by a triplet of red, green, and blue, which are numbers that specify the intensity in each of those color bands. And since your eye is sensitive only to 3 different wavelength bands, this is generally enough to reproduce any color, more or less. And so when you take an image or whatever, your camera has red, green, and blue sensors in it. So an example of a transform is you can multiply by this matrix, which creates what's called a YCRCB. So that is designed to create the top element is the intensity, like a black and white image, and then the other two are the differences of 2 of the color channels from that intensity image. And what this does is it concentrates a lot of the image detail in the black and white image so that you only have to encode the differences. So for example, we could take a nice picture of Prague, which has red, green, and blue triplets at every pixel. And if we split out each of those components, you can see there's a red image, a green image, and a blue image. If you overlay all of these optically, it will look like the previous picture. But if you look at them, they all individually look like the same picture. You can see all the same details in all of them. But if we do a matrix multiplication to rotate to a coordinate system where we have, this is actually CR, Y, and CB, the red channel looks similar to the black and white channel, so it doesn't help that much. But if you look at the blue one, it's pretty much 2 colors. There's a lot less detail involved. It's basically, is there a roof or not? And that blue image there will be much easier to compress. So by changing from the RGB color space to the YCRCB color space, we've arranged the data so that it can be compressed more efficiently. Because the Y channel would be just as hard to compress as the RGB channel, but the blue channel is much easier. So in general, you want to transform. Something that JPEG, Theora, and Vorbis all use is the Fourier transform. Jack showed you an example with audio. And what you do there is you chop the image up into little blocks, mostly for efficiency, and you Fourier transform each one. And that tends to concentrate the data. Well, in natural images, If it's an artificial one with sharp edges, it doesn't help much. But in a natural image, things are generally smoothly varying, which means most of the information is low-frequency information. So it's a more efficient way to store it. These techniques only go so far, and to do better, we need something else. In general, it's hard to do better than a factor of 5 with a lossless compression algorithm. Ping is pretty close to that for a lot of examples. FLAC doesn't really do that well. You rarely get better than a factor of 3 with FLAC. So to really get the kind of compression that people want to ship video over the internet, you have to go to a lossless compression. You can't use lossless compression. You have to use lossy compression. So the thing is, with multimedia, you just want to watch it. You don't necessarily need the original. So as long as you have something that looks or sounds more or less the same, you don't care whether it's exactly bent identical to what went in. So we can take advantage of not just mathematical redundancy, but perceptual redundancy. Things that look the same to you that aren't important to the way it looks, but that save a lot of space in the file. So one common approach is to, after you've transformed, to truncate the data. What JPEG does is, after it's Fourier transformed all these blocks, it throws away the high frequency information. So the Fourier transform concentrates the information in one corner because it's all low frequency things. And then all the high frequency things just get cut off. And since the image is mostly smoothly varying, you lose some of the fine detail. But if you just look at it, it looks all right. With another trick that's done in both JPEG and Theora is you do a YUV transform. So you have intensity and then the two color difference channels. And it turns out your eye is more sensitive to intensity variations than it is to color variations. So you can subsample. You can basically scale down the color images, the color difference images, and just keep the full resolution with the intensity image. And that cuts the amount of data you have to compress by a third. So another thing is just to represent what you store less accurately. This is usually referred to as quantization. So instead of storing 8-bit values, you store 6-bit values. And in general, in Theora, there's a whole matrix where after you've transformed the data, you decide how many bits you're going to spend on each component so that you can control how accurately you represent high frequencies versus low frequencies on an individual basis. An example of why this works, this is called Campbell-Robson contrast sensitivity chart. And the horizontal axis is increasing horizontal frequency, spatial frequency, and the vertical axis is decreasing sensitivity, or contrast. So you have white and black bands at the bottom fading into just solid gray at the top. And if you look at sort of the point where you can't see the dark bands anymore, and it just blurs into gray, that appears to fall down towards the high spatial frequency end. And this is just a demonstration that your eye is less sensitive to high frequency information. And so you don't need to encode stuff that happens way out there in the bit that's gray where you can't see what's happening. You can throw it away and your eye won't be able to see the difference. And what's not obvious from this chart is that in image compression, that corner up there actually accounts for a lot of the data. So you can save half the data by throwing away the tiny little corner up there in the upper left where you can't see anything anyway. So I was invited here to speak about Theora, our free video codec. I've talked about some of the ways compression works. Let's talk about Theora specifically. Theora is a free codec, but it's in the same family as the MPEG-1 and MPEG-2 video codecs that you're familiar with. That's, people have been putting video on the internet in MPEG-1 for at least a decade. And MPEG-2 is popular as the codec that's used for video on DVDs. It's based on the discrete cosine transform, which is an integer version of the Fourier transform we've been talking about. And then motion compensation is done by copying blocks. So to explain what that means, we're always looking for ways to remove redundancy. And in still images, all you can do is work with that frame you have. You can transform it and throw away pieces of high frequency and so on. But an obvious difference with video is that you have a succession of frames. And generally, things don't change all that much from one frame to the next. I mean, if you look at video of me standing here, The background never changes. I wave my hands, and my hands move from one place in the frame to another. So the most important thing to exploit when you're compressing video is the differences between frames. You don't want to encode the whole frame over again. You want to encode only what has changed. So Theora does this by copying from by dividing the frame into blocks. And then for each block, you can say this block is changed, but it looks a little bit like this block over here in the previous frame. So we predict the new frame by copying a block. And then once we've recorded all these changes, we Huffman code them and stuff them in a bitstream. The distinguishing features of Theora, what makes it different from other codecs that are available, is it supports arbitrary frame sizes. A lot of video codecs support only a factor of 8 or a factor of 16 in frame size, so you're limited to certain things. MPEG actually is limited to a factor of 8, but they have profiles where if you want a DVD player, it's only going to work at one resolution. If you have a DVB stream, it'll only work at 4 different resolutions. So we're much more flexible that way. Unlike the MPEG codecs, it only uses backward references. So MPEG, to try and save space and compress things more efficiently, you can not only copy blocks from my hand was over here in the previous frame, you can say my hand was over here in the future frame. And that does save them, give some efficiency, but it's also really confusing because to decode this frame, you have to have decoded the next frame, and how do you do that? And so the frames are sent not right in the quite order, they're not sent in temporal order, they're sent in the order you need to decode them, and it adds latency, so if you're doing video conferencing, it makes things a little slower. And it just makes the whole program more complicated. The other thing is, similar to what we did with Vorbis, Theora is designed to degrade more gracefully when you compress the video too hard. So if you take if you've ever seen a JPEG image that's been compressed too hard, so they're trying to get it really small, but you get things look sort of blocky and there's noise everywhere, and it doesn't look very good. And Theora, I mean, again, if you squeeze the video too hard, it'll start to look bad. But what's different from, for example, the MPEG codecs is that it tends to blur instead of going blocky. And blocks have sharp edges, and your eye is very sensitive to sharp edges, so you really notice the blocks. Whereas a lot of people find that if things just get sort of blurry and fuzzed out, it's still not very nice looking, but it's much less noticeable if you're just trying to watch the video. So a lot of people find that that's an improvement. Another thing that we do that's special is we actually have accurate color representation. You can be specific about the color space that your video is encoded in. And that lets you, if you're an artist and you care about exactly what your video looks like, with Theora you can say. Most video codecs, if you buy a PAL DVD, then it's supposed to be PAL, but if you download a movie off Apple's QuickTime website, a movie trailer, it's going to look like whatever it looks like on your computer, and that may or may not be what the filmmaker intended. So with Theora, you can be specific about that. So just to go into more detail there, our idea is to put the complexity in the encoder, because you only encode once, and then lots and lots of people will decode the video. So we want the decoder to be simple, and the encoder can be as complicated as it has to be. So in the Theora bitstream, you can only have three color spaces. There's one that's fairly close to PAL, and all the various PAL variations can be easily converted to it. There's one that's close to NTSC, which is used in North America and Japan. And then there's an unknown color space, which means I didn't want to bother converting it. I just want it to look like whatever the user wants it to look like. Oddly enough, that often looks better. Not more accurate, but better, because the digital television standards don't use the full dynamic range. We have 8-bit samples in Theora, but they cut off 16 at the bottom and 30 at the top. And this is meant to protect hardware from overruns. But it ends up making the video look washed out if you watch it on a computer screen instead of a television. Whereas if you use the unknown color space, you can use the full range, and it often looks better. But again, you don't have good control over if the hues are exactly what you want them to be. So what's the structure of a Theora video stream? Theora takes frames, one after another, and it converts them into a stream of packets. And each packet is an independent unit that contains the video. So the stream starts out with 3 header packets, and then there's a sequence of frame data. And the frame data will have a keyframe, which is compressed like an image, a still image, all by itself. And then there will be a sequence of frames that record only the difference to the previous frames. So the headers are at the beginning to help identify the stream and set up the codec. There's an info header that identifies that says this is a Theora video, and it records some basic information like the size of the frame, how many frames per second to play it back at, how often are we going to expect keyframes, what's the color space, what's the color subsampling, what's the nominal bitrate, things like that. So that's just a short thing that, I mean, if you ran a file on it, that's what it would tell you. There's a comment header, which, like Vorbis, gives you basic metadata, so you can put the author and the title and the director and things like that in there. It's actually the same format as we used for Vorbis, because we like it a lot. And it's really designed for quick notes, the author, the title, but you wouldn't want to put a full movie, you know, the 25 pages of credits you have on a full Hollywood movie in there. And then there's the table header, which contains all the setup information for the decoder, not the frame size and whatever. But one thing we've done with Vorbis that's been very successful and that we've now done with Theora is we've put a lot of the decoder's configuration information, the Huffman tables it uses, the quantization matrices we use, inside the bitstream. And this means that if you come up with a better way to compress, to tune the encoder later, you can just write those differences to the bitstream, and old decoders will still be able to play it. And this has been tremendously successful. As Jack said, when we started out with Vorbis, it was a little bit better than MP3. And now it's far better than MP3. It sounds just as good at half the bitrate. And it's as good as anything except the new version of AAC that came out 6 months ago. And all of that is possible. It's possible to play those much better files with a four-year-old decoder, because the decoder hasn't changed. It's just the tuning of the encoder and the details that we put in the setup header that's different. So we're just starting with Theora. It's better than MPEG 1. It's better than MPEG 2. It's about comparable with the MPEG 4 encoders from a year ago. But we have a lot of room by tuning the encoder and changing the details of this table header to do things better. And then there's a keyframe packet, which, as I said, is a complete image, a single frame that's recoded without reference to other frames. You have to do this at the start because, of course, there's no frames in the past that you can reference to copy movements from. And it's sort of the Theora equivalent of JPEG. Slightly more efficient, but similar idea. And then most of the frames in the stream will be delta frames. So they are encoded, they encode only the changes from the last frame and also from the previous keyframe. And so the encoder can make decisions about the things that haven't changed at all. You can always refer to the original in the keyframe, and noise won't accumulate and spill out as you keep making differences and differences. Or you can encode just from the last frame for something that's moving quickly. And Theora is always one frame per packet, so it's very easy to sort out. It's not all packed together like some video formats. So how is a Theora frame actually decoded? How does the codec actually work? So there's a lot of steps here. The first thing you do is you look at your data packet and you say, is this a keyframe or is it a delta frame? If it's a keyframe, then we're just going to be decoding a still image. We can throw away everything we've remembered about previous frames, and we're going to be starting again. If it's a delta frame, then we're going to need to copy things from the previous frame, and decoding will be more complicated because there's more steps. So, first thing you do is you read the list of blocks that have changed since the last one. So is there anything? So we've divided the image again up into little blocks, and you treat each block differently. And that just lets us localize our changes and say that this part hasn't moved and this part has. So you read a list of blocks that have been changed so you know how much of everything you need. If it's a keyframe, then you know all the blocks are changed, so you don't have to do this step. Then there's a list of modes, which says for each block, is this block a replacement for a previous block, or is it something we're going to copy from a previous frame? If we're going to copy it from the previous frame, sort of what kind of copy is it? Is it aligned with pixels? Is it not aligned with pixels? Does it have four directions or only one direction? That sort of thing. And then you read a list of motion vectors and quantum matrix selectors. So remember we talked about you can copy a block from a previous frame to here, and there's an offset between them because you're trying to say it's moved. So four blocks that are coded, and four blocks whose coding mode says there should be a motion vector, then you have to read the motion vector. obviously, if it's a keyframe, there are no motion vectors because there's no copying from previous blocks, and there isn't any of this. One thing that does happen in both keyframes and delta frames is you can choose what kind of quantization matrix you want for each block. And this lets you not waste energy encoding really boring parts of the image. And then you can concentrate the detail and spend a lot of bits on the bits of the image that are important to look at. And then finally, you read the discrete cosine transform coefficients. So again, remember we talked about you're going to Fourier transform. So each block, just like in JPEG, just like in MPEG, Theora, each block is Fourier transformed, which concentrates information. And then we use these quantization matrices to encode it with a variable amount of precision. So you have to read all of these things out of the frame. And then you put it all together. So just like with FLAC, just like we talked about with Ping, you can think about what Theora does is predicting what the frame is going to be. So for each block that has been coded that's different, that where something has changed, you create a predictor by copying things from previous blocks. So that's what the motion vectors do. The zeroth coefficient, which just controls the overall intensity of a block, is also predicted from its neighbors, because in general, we're dividing things into 8x8 blocks, but often there are smoother, slower changes in the image intensity from that. So this lets us pick up that and save some information. And then that makes that predicts a block saying, you know, something has moved from the previous frame, or it's the same as the previous frame. And then you can, and then based on that, you can only record what's changed from the predictor. So instead of having to record, the entire IBM here, you can just say copy the IBM from the previous frame and then paste my finger on top of it. And that's what the DCT coefficients do. So that's more or less how it goes. You can ask me questions if any of that didn't make sense. I also want to talk about Theora as a general media format. We've just talked about how it compresses video. But video by itself is boring. You want to listen to things, too. Ever since anybody's been able to do that, everybody likes to go to the talkies, not just the silent movies. So we have this Ogg multimedia container. It's a little bit like QuickTime, a little bit like AVI, but much better. Like Microsoft's AVS and the MPEG program stream are other examples. But we like it a lot. It's an open format that we control, and it's very flexible, very good for streaming and file storage. And it lets you mix multiple things together. Most people just know Ogg files as Ogg Vorbis files, which only contain video. I'm sorry, only contain audio. But it's designed from the beginning to let you mix together multiple streams. So you can have a track of audio, and you can have a track of video. You can even have audio, video, subtitles, video with two different language tracks, anything like that. So the basic thing is we take Theora video, and we take Vorbis audio, and we put them together in an Ogg file, and that gives you a real movie. Ogg isn't just for Vorbis, but Ogg Theora, with this ability to add other codecs together, makes a complete multimedia. That's the ability to seek, to jump to different parts in the frame, because it records timestamps. So you can say, I want to go to 3 minutes into the stream, and it gives you an easy way to do binary search to find that part of the stream, even though all of the codecs inside are variable bitrate. Seeking used to be really easy back when codecs always took a fixed amount of information, compressed it by a fixed amount. But that's really inefficient because you don't always need that much to encode things. And sometimes it makes it look bad because you really needed more to get a decent quality. So most codecs now are variable bitrate. You take a fixed size frame or a fixed block of audio, and you compress it into some random size. So you can't just calculate how far you need to go to get 6 minutes into the video. You have to do a search. So Ogg supports that for all the different codecs. We also like to use Ming, which stands for Motion Network Image Graphics. So it's an extension of the Ping image format, which is, of course, free and not patented, that does animations. And you can use that to overlay your Theora video with graphical subtitles, just like DVDs do, or to do spinning logos or to do the credits, because Ming can compress something that's just like 2 bits, like text, more efficiently than a lossy encoder like Theora. And we're also working on developing text-based subtitles. There's a few that people are already using, and we may adopt those, but we also have our own format called RIT. that we think is a little better designed and does a better job handling international text. So, and just being able to do gives us also an easy way to do HTTP streaming. Jack talked about the Icecast project that we've had for a long time for streaming OGG, and it also streams Theora in OGG. And as with OGG Vorbis files, you can also just put them up on your web server because we use HTTP for streaming. It doesn't matter whether you have a special server, which is nice if you're doing live streaming, or if you just have static files, people can just download it on the fly and play it. So OGG Theora works fine in starting an effort to create an RTP payload format.
We're also working on an RTP payload format. This has just started. There's been some efforts with Vorbis before. And as Jack says, we've never been terribly interested because RTP makes the most sense for multicast, and almost no one has multicast access. But more people are getting it. The BBC has talked about trying to get it nationally distributed to all broadband users in the UK, which would be 30 million people who can get who can use RTP. So that would be a major goal. And so we're just starting an effort there. If any of you know anything about RTP and would like to help us out, we could use some help designing the payload format. And of course, Theora just creates these packets, and you can put them in any other format. We like OGG. We think it's the best option. But you could put Theora in QuickTime, for example, if you like Apple stuff. So the current status of Theora, the reference implementation is alpha. It's not alpha because it's buggy, and it's not alpha because we're going to change the format. The code is actually quite stable, and in July we froze the bitstream. So if you encode something using the Alpha 3 reference encoder, you'll always be able to play it. We guarantee we'll support that. But we are going to change the API before the final release because what we have now is less efficient than it could be. So that's the main difference between Alpha 3 and the beta release that's coming up. So just because the API is going to change, you shouldn't let that stop you from using it. The changes will be fairly minor. And we already have very good support in a lot of open source players. VLC, a student project from France, has supported us for about a year. And that's, I think, my favorite player. It runs on macOS, it runs on Windows, it runs on Linux, it runs on almost all Unixes. And it does a very good job playing a lot of different formats. But in particular, it's a good Theora format and supports streaming and everything else. The GStreamer framework, part of the GNOME project, supports Theora. So does the Zine Media framework. In an interesting reversal, Real, who used to be the ultimate enemy of free media formats, has created this open source base player called Helix Player, and that supports Theora and Vorbis, and only Theora and Vorbis, because as a US company, they can't afford to distribute anything else as open source because they have to worry about patents. The Linux version of Real Player 10.01, the very latest release, plays Theora out of the box. I think the Windows and the Mac versions don't, but there are plugins you can download if you want to play Theora there. We have a set of direct show plugins written by a programmer in Australia. They're still under development, so they're a bit buggy, but I understand they work fine for playing back in Windows Media Player. Also, there's a company in Barcelona called Fluindo. It's a new startup that's trying to create streaming server software and selling it to corporations, but also maintain a GPL version and use it to fund work in the open source community. And one of their programmers wrote a Java applet, which Jack mentioned, I guess, as well, which is really amazing. I think it's about as fast as the C implementation. And it's great because you can go to the web page and it'll play Theora video without you having to do anything. And there are Debian packages, which I thought nobody would care about, but everybody here seems to use Debian, even the SUSE guy. So it's fairly easy to start using it. Encoder support is a little less advanced. You have to work a little harder. The best option for people on Linux is a program written by Jan Gerber in Germany called FFmpeg to Theora. It uses the FFmpeg project to parse just about anything. I mostly use it with DV video because transcoding from MPEG doesn't give you as good results And it's a nice command line program that will call Theora and make a Theora video out of anything FFmpeg Theora, FFmpeg play. So like the AVI files my little digital camera makes make fine videos. There's a reference encoder with the example, basically, that comes with the reference implementation. It's a little difficult to use. You have to get your video into a particular RAW format that's used by the Linux audio video tools. But it works fine. It's good for playing with it. There are beta versions of plugins for Real Producer. So if you have Real Producer and you use it to do your streaming already, you can switch to Theora if you want. And so, again, we have this bizarre situation where people can switch from their evil proprietary system without switching from their evil proprietary system. They can use free plugins. And this company, Fluendo in Barcelona, is planning to release a streaming server that does Theora and Vorbis and all of our other codecs. And they say it's going to be GPL. They haven't done it yet. It's the latest milestone I heard was that it's supposed to come out tomorrow. So you can check there and see if you can get the source code and try it out. And it looks very nice. And that's all I have to say. Thank you very much. And does anyone have any questions?
I'd like to ask, sorry, I'd like to ask if you plan to use a wavelet compression in this Theora.
Plan to use what, I'm sorry?
Wavelet.
Oh, wavelet compression. Probably not in Theora. I didn't talk about the history very much. Theora is based on the VP3 codec, which was donated by a company called Onto. And they carefully, the patents on audio compression are bad. The patents on video compression are impossible. Almost everything that anyone has ever published is patented. So they did a lot of the hard work to figure out what could be done. And I think it works fairly well, given what it is. A lot of the experiments with wavelets haven't been as successful as everyone thinks they will be. I mean, we've had our own research project called Tarkin that's supposed to use wavelet compression. And it does okay, but it's not clear that it's, no. The thing is it's hard to figure out how to do the motion with wavelets. The most important thing in compressing video is exploiting the redundancy between successive frames. And that's where I think most of the improvement will come. And it's hard to make a big improvement just by using wavelets instead of the DCT. So we don't plan to do that for Theora, but probably for the next codec.
Okay, thank you. And is there any scalability to mobile devices, like basic layer and enhancement layer and so on? So you can use as much as there as that particular device can handle.
Yeah, we don't have particular profiles. There's not really anything that's optional in the design itself, but it's also, unlike like the new MPEG-4 codecs, there's pretty much everything is required. There's no extra stuff that is really optional if you're going to decode anything at all. So basically, the only issue is just make it small enough you can decode it. There actually is a Symbian OS build of Theora, so you can watch Theora videos on your cell phone if you have one of those 300 euro ones that run Java or Symbian OS. But we don't have any specific plans for that.
And my last question, do you have any system to correct errors in frames? It means if there's error in the frame, you have to drop all frame, or you can save as much as possible and show something.
You mean drop in a network stream, or just if there's a single
in
coding error?
MPEG-4 ISO, there's a system. They have redundant headers and some control points in that data. So they can repair a part from the stream and use as much as possible, even if there were some errors.
I see. Yeah, there's nothing in the current code for that. Jean-Marc, the guy who wrote the Speaks codec, has a lot of ideas for how to do, he calls it covering, where you sort of interpolate over bad data and try and construct the best thing you can. And he'd like to do, Speaks already does that. It's essential for doing voice communications in real time. But he'd like to do that for Vorbis and for Theora. The other thing is you can do a lot of things with live encoding modes, where, for example, I've talked about how you can copy blocks from previous frames. But one thing you can do is also just code the single block new. And if you make sure that you always code every block new every couple of seconds, then even if you never have a keyframe, you can still always repair any damage that was done from a missing frame relatively quickly. So we've talked about doing that in the encoder for live streaming and things like that. Is that what you meant?
Yes, okay. And even I said it was last. I'd like to ask now, you have keyframes and data frames. Do you have also B frames?
No, there are no B frames in Theora. They turned out not to be necessary. I mean, as I said, they add a lot of complexity. And the other changes that we made to the current compression algorithm that are different from MP3, that are different from the MPEG video, make up the difference. So we decided they weren't worth the effort of adding them. We couldn't make them add that much to the compression.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe I missed something, but I haven't seen the keyframes are repeated in some intervals.
Yes. So, I mean, the screen wasn't wide enough to draw that. So generally, the keyframe does reoccur periodically. Depending on what you want to do, you vary that rate. You get better compression if you put them far apart, but you can't join a stream in the middle. You have to wait for the next keyframe. So the reference encoder puts them every 30 to 100 frames. Mm-hmm. Also, if there's a sudden change in the scene, like if there's a sharp cut in the video, then generally you want to do a keyframe there because everything in the image is changing anyway. So it's a good time to do it.
So you have a detection in the encoder too.
Yes.
If the delta is too big, then you just put a keyframe.
Exactly.
Yeah, because it supports skipping and seeking, but you can't really seek without a keyframe.
Yes, that's right. And there's a clever hack with the timestamps where you can always tell from a Theora Aug page exactly how far you are from the last keyframe. So the way seeking works is you do bisection search to find the point in time you want, and then you can jump backwards just enough to get the last keyframe and then start decoding from there.
Yeah, thanks.
When the decoders get mature and optimized enough, what hardware do you think I will need to play back a video stream in a DVD-like quality?
Well, it depends on how big a video you want to watch.
I don't know.
Yes. So the current hardware, it takes about a gigahertz machine to watch normal video, maybe a gigahertz and a half. And we can improve that by at least a factor of 4, probably a factor of 6. So to watch full-screen DVD quality video, you'd need about a 400 megahertz machine, which is pretty much the same as MPEG 2. It's not really that much more complicated. It'll probably be a year before it's that fast. Yeah. Fluendo actually did an MMX-optimized version of the encoder, which turns out to be easier. You have to be very careful when you optimize the decoder that you get things exactly mathematically correct, because since you're always calculating differences between frames, any decoding error you make will accumulate and get worse and worse and worse. But the encoder can always check its work by running it through the decoder. So you can have the encoder use a really, really fast transform that's not accurate and then just fix up the details later. And they were able to speed up the encoder by a factor of 4 in about 2 weeks worth of work. I think the programs are probably a genius, but still, there's lots of gains to be made. Anything else?
Ralph, did you mention any numbers, like how much is the compression ratio?
Oh.
Or I didn't pay attention.
Yeah, I'm not great off the top of my head. The videos I was showing are around 8 megabytes for their quarter screen resolution. So 8 megabytes over 2 minutes, whatever that works out to. Those are not great quality, but they're fine for streaming on broadband.
I had a question regarding the speed of compression encoding. Mm-hmm. I tried compressing one DVD video, say, half a year ago on a quite new machine, so say 2 gigahertz Athlon with half a gig RAM, and it took about 8 hours. Mm-hmm. To encode to Theora. Is there any progress in this area?
Yes. So we have patches that speed up encode by a factor of 4.
Great.
So that would be real time for DVD on your machine. Okay. Thank you very much.